Hello and welcome to The Writer's Way, a Right Attitude radio show. This program is brought to you by the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative that enhances student learning by fostering positive attitudes toward writing. I'm your host, Sierra Walton. For today's show, we are focusing on two authors, Karen Abbott and Pearl Clegg, who are both known for developing strong female characters. While these authors differ with regard to their subject matter, they both seek to shed light on the lives and struggles of women at various points in history. We will share with you interviews with each author as they talk about their work and their writing process, as well as give advice to aspiring writers and students who often find themselves frustrated by writing. Toward the end of our show, be sure to stay tuned for the recording of two plays written by Pearl Clegg, adapted and directed by SSU professor Daryl Thompson, and performed by our students Maya Codwell and Natalie Goings. To begin, we'll first listen to an interview with Karen Abbott in two parts, in which she discusses her career as a writer of historical nonfiction. Abbott is the author of three books, each one highlighting the often underappreciated roles of women in the shaping of American history. Through intensive research into primary and secondary source material, including letters and personal diaries, she brings her characters to life in vivid detail. Abbott was one of the selected best-selling authors of the Savannah Book Festival in 2015. In February 2015, when presenting in the festival, Abbott visited Savannah State University and delivered a lecture to our students, faculty, and staff members. The interview was conducted by Sandra Early, a professor of our own Department of Journalism and Mass Communications, and myself. Besides being your host, I'm a student and the QEP Communications intern at Savannah State University. Here now is the first part of her interview.
Hello, I'm Sandra Early. I'm an assistant professor of online journalism in the Department of Journalism and Mass Communications here at Savannah State. With me today is Karen Abbott, a writer who's in town for the Savannah Book Festival, and we're going to talk about bringing the past to life through writing. Miss Abbott really knows how to tell a story and how to sell a story, and she's not even making them up. She writes history, nonfiction, and her books are anything but the dry and heavy stereotype applied to books of history. Your books are cultural history, is that fair? With sizzle.
Yes.
Okay. Just listen to the titles of her three books so you'll know why the word sizzle applies. And remember, these stories are true. They're not fiction. Sin in the Second City, Madams, Ministers, Playboys, and the Battle for America's Soul. American Rose, A Nation Laid Bare, The Life and Times of Gypsy Rose Lee. Bears a pun. Who's Gypsy Rose Lee?
Gypsy Rose Lee was perhaps the most famous ecdysiast, in the words of H.L. Mencken, more commonly known as a stripper or burlesque performer in the 1920s and 30s. But she was also much more than that. She was a writer from The New Yorker. She was a playwright. She was a novelist. She was a member of the New York intelligentsia and literati. And pretty much her life was a microcosm of 20th century America, and I wanted to, with that book, view America through the lens of this very dynamic and fascinating woman's life.
The third one, the yes. newest one, out last September,
yes,
is Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. That's two spies for the North and two spies for the South,
right.
All colorful and brave. I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit later. A little biography. Ms. Abbott began her writing career as a magazine journalist in her native Philadelphia. These days she lives in New York, writes frequently for the online editions of the New York Times, Smithsonian Magazine, and then the online magazine Slate. Her blog is called Wicked History. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Okay. So where do your ideas come from?
Well, most of mine actually come from my grandmother, who is now 96 years old. Actually, I had never been really interested in history. I was a journalist mm-hmm. writing about current events and mm-hmm. current topics. But my grandmother told me a story about her mother and her mother's sister, who came over from Slovenia in 1905
wow.
to the United States. And one weekend, the sister went to Chicago and was never heard from again. So I was always intrigued and haunted by this bit of family lore and wondering what happened to this missing ancestor. And I began looking into Chicago in 1905 and came upon a story about Marshall Field Jr., the son of the department store magnate.
Yeah.
And he was shot. And the rumor was that he was shot in a brothel, a world-famous brothel called the Everly Club. So, as terrible as it sounds, I immediately forgot all about my missing ancestor and was much more intrigued by these two madams, these sort of enigmatic, mysterious sisters from Virginia who sort of reinvented themselves and became the most famous madams of the most lavish brothel in history. And from then on, I wanted to write about history pretty much exclusively.
This is curiosity, and it is everything that journalism starts out to be, but you're carrying it into talking about history. That's wonderful. Okay, so your books are cultural history, sometimes called sizzle history. Is that fair?
I do, and you know, I always am surprised that somebody, because a couple times people have asked me, oh, do you think a man would be called a sizzle historian? And maybe not, but I will say that a woman journalist is the one who came up with it, and a woman journalist I respect, and I thought, I didn't take it in a sort of salacious or sexual connotation. I thought about it more in trying to make history exciting for people who might not normally find history interesting. So to me, sizzle sort of taking the forgotten bits of history and forgotten characters of history who are maybe a little bit are living on the edges, a little bit subversive, a little bit daring and risky. And so to me, that's what sizzle connotes.
And you find yourself writing a lot about women.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as we all know, history is usually written by, about, and for men. The women's stories are often forgotten or put to the wayside or really not given the attention they're due. And to me, it's a great fun and an honor to try to resurrect these women and make them their exploits and their personalities and their lives known to a whole new generation of people.
Absolutely. Okay, now we get into the part where you give advice about how to write and how to do it. So we're talking about bringing the past to life in a book. How do you do that? What's the secret?
I think the most important factor in terms of writing, you know, what you would call maybe a dry academic history versus a narrative history is the details. Mm-hmm. Details are what make a scene or a character come to life.
Absolutely.
So in order to do details, you have to do the research. And research is my favorite part of the process. It's kind of like a detective search. You never know. And I don't like doing online research. Everything already there is really curated for you. Somebody's already gone through it and picked what they wanted to put online and arranged it for you. And it's not quite the same as going to the archives yourself and physically touching the box and saying, I don't know what's going to be in the next box or the next folder. And it's a surprise. And there's always an element of surprise in there and maybe something you weren't expecting to find and something that makes an emotional connection for you to the material. I remember for my book about female Civil War spies, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, I found one of the death threats that the spy received. And I thought, you know, I was chilled reading that death threat in, you know, current day, and I can't imagine what she felt reading this and holding this in her hands back in 1864. So it's the kind of thing that you're not going to experience if you do research solely online.
Boy, is that the truth.
Yeah.
And that the details are incredibly important, and doing original research with the original documents is the way to go, it seems to me. So, which is actually leads us to a good question. You started in journalism. What impact did that have on all of this?
I think journalism actually trains you to find what details are going to make a story work. Because especially in journalism, when you have a word count limit, you have 800 words. How are you going to get to the crux of this? How are you going to make this character pop in a sentence or two? And I think journalism gives you that sort of eye for the exact right detail. And you can't try to be funny. You can't try to be poignant. You can't try to be smart. You have to let the details be funny and poignant and smart for you. So I think journalism really teaches you how to distill the information you get into a compact story and to cut, you know, you learn that your words aren't precious. You learn that you can cut them and you'll live.
That's exactly right. Which leads us to a favorite detail. You have Belle Boyd, who is a very flamboyant Southern belle in the latest book. Do you have a favorite detail about her?
I do. She, Belle Boyd, was very overt for her time period. She was sort of very overt about her opinions and her sexuality in a way that was very uncommon for a girl of that time period. And she would say outrageous things about generals and the generals she was trying to seduce. And she was particularly obsessed with Confederate General Stonewall Jackson.
Oh, yeah.
And she would tell, this was one of my favorite quotes, she would tell people, she told a Northern reporter that she wanted to, quote, occupy Stonewall's tent and share his dangers. which, if I were Stonewall Jackson, I always say would have frightened me more than anything the Union Army had in store for me, because she was quite a character and hot-headed and flew off the handle easily. I mean, she opens the book by shooting a Union soldier and getting away with it.
That's my favorite detail.
Yeah. Well, that one too.
he's in her front hall,
yeah.
And she plucks him between the eyes or something.
Yeah.
Or was it in the chest? I can't remember.
I don't even know if it was actually specified where she shot him, but it was a fatal shot. And
she got away with it.
She got away with it.
Which is an interesting question to me, too. These women were, for the most part, upper class women, and seemed to me protected in their spying by their rank in society and by their wealth.
Right.
Is that accurate?
I'd say that's definitely fair. And also, just the society's expectations of what women were and weren't capable of. And these women brilliantly exploited the idea of the weaker sex. And use their gender as both a physical and psychological disguise. Physically, they're hiding dispatches and secrets up in their hair or in their corsets or in their stockings. Mm-hmm. And psychologically, if anybody accuses them of treasonous activity, the customary response was, how dare you? I am a defenseless woman. And it was, the men usually... Exactly. Exactly. And it worked.
It did indeed. Talk a little bit about Elizabeth Van Loo, who was a rich matron, actually matron maybe doesn't apply because she was never married,
right.
But in Richmond. She was very liberal, spied for the North, had servants in her household, not slaves, sent some of her servants north to be educated, mm-hmm. and she used one of those, Mary Elizabeth Bowser, to spy.
She was a remarkable woman, Elizabeth Van Loo, and I really believe that without her and her spy ring and the servants that she employed, the North would not have won the war. And she had quite an interesting background. She was born and raised in Richmond, but sent north to Philadelphia to be educated and was under the care of an abolitionist governess, and came back to Richmond and was appalled by slavery and appalled by the conditions of the slaves in Richmond, and freed all of her family's slaves. And as you said, a lot of them stayed on to work with the family for wage.
Yeah.
And she took a special shine to one former slave, Mary Bowser, and decides to place her as a spy in the Confederate White House. Verena Davis, the first lady of the Confederacy, put out a call and said, I'm staffing the White House, I need help. And Elizabeth pays her a visit and says, I have a girl for you. She's not very bright. And she stumbles in the kitchen, but she'll serve your family well. And so little does anybody know that Mary Bowser is not only literate, but highly educated and gifted with a photographic memory, a really brilliant
woman. That, yeah.
And so while she's dusting Jefferson Davis's desk and picking up the children's toys, she's also sneaking peeks at his confidential papers and eavesdropping on conversations and reporting all of this back to Elizabeth at great risk to her own life.
Absolutely.
Let's have a break and we will be back with more of The Writer's Way, a Right Attitude radio show.
I'm Dr. Lisa Yaunt, the director of the Right Attitude Program at Savannah State University. Here's the writing tip of the day.
Hello, this is a writing tip from the Savannah State Writing Center. Diction or word choice is important in academic writing. For instance, you may write that the results of an experiment were unexpected, whereas in more informal situations, you may simply say it was weird. Remember that the written language is typically more formal and structured than spoken word.
The Right Attitude Writing Tip of the Day is brought to you by the SSU Writing Center and the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative to enhance student learning by improving attitudes about writing. Visit the SSU Writing Center in Payne Hall to get assistance with your writing projects, and to learn more about how you can improve your writing attitudes and skills, visit qep.savannahstate.edu.
Welcome back to The Writer's Way. You have just heard part one of our interview with Karen Abbott. In the second half of the interview, which we will play for you now, she talks about what her typical day of writing looks like, shares some of the best writing advice she has ever received, and adds some advice of her own. Enjoy!
What's a typical writing day for you like? Or, for that matter, is a typical writing day a research day?
It depends. You know, I'm somebody who has to, and I know a lot of people do this differently, I have to research and write at the same time, or else I would allow myself to fall down the rabbit hole of research and never emerge. I would just stay in the research phase and then end up having about 2 months to write, which isn't a good idea. So I try to research and write at the same time, and I think this is another journalism tactic that helped me. I would, you know, if I didn't know something or if I needed to flesh it out, I knew it was thin, I would write it TKs everywhere, TK, yeah. TK, TK, and then
to
I would
come,
go back.
To come.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, a research and writing day would probably, you know, simultaneously I would do them both. And I have two birds who wake me up every morning. Literally, they're in my bedroom. I live in New York City in a tiny apartment, and they're like right there, and they wake me up. And then I try to get as much done as I can. You know, if I can get down 1,000 words in a day, that's a really good day.
So you write in the morning, write in the afternoon?
I try to write in the morning, as close to the morning as I can get. I'm a night owl, so, and a bit of an insomniac, so my morning writing might start at 11:30, so.
I think the point about writing in sections and writing as you do research is very important. I think that students find it really daunting to approach a story that's even 1,000 words, 3,000 words long. We have with us a student today who's going to ask some questions later, Sierra Walton. Mm-hmm. And you're nodding your head. You know what we're talking about here. So I think that's a really important way to approach dealing with a lot of information. Okay, now it's the advice time. What's the best writing advice you ever got, and what do you want to add to that?
I remember one of my first, not editors, a fellow reporter who was older and had a lot of experience, always said, write about what terrifies you and what thrills you. So I always thought that that was really smart advice. And once I moved to Atlanta and I found some fellow writers in a writing group, their advice was, and I always thought this was good too, find people who are better than you, and surround yourself with people who are better than you, and don't be slotty. Slotty thinking is, you know, comparing yourself, your career trajectory to somebody else's. There's room enough for everybody. There's room enough for all kinds of stories. And somebody's success isn't going to negate your own success or diminish your own chances. So that's the kind of thing that once you're actually in publishing and you have to constantly remind yourself. Comparison is the thief of joy, as they say.
That's David Halberstam, a great reporter for the New York Times, Vietnam War correspondent and later writer of books, used to tell people to find a writer that they liked and take a story written by that article and that person and take it apart and see how it works and use the ideas that they use for structure and that sort of thing. He also recommended reading crime fiction because crime fiction writers know how to tell really good stories.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think that's...
That's great advice.
Advice to live by. Back to particularly students and their work. We live in a really copy-paste online world. One thing that doing original research from the books and the papers themselves prevents is copy-paste.
Right.
But nonetheless, it's a reality, and plagiarism, I think, plagues students perhaps more than at any other time.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of primary and secondary sources. Oh my goodness, the lists at the end of the essays and at the end of the books are extensive. So how do you keep from inadvertent plagiarism?
Inadvertent is the key. I think it's you know, especially when you're writing something like a blog piece and it's, you know, just a certain amount of words and you're trying to get it out there quickly, it's easy to just, and you're taking notes and the notes you're taking are from the book that and you have to just remember that not to, you know, take it verbatim. And in terms of book work, what I try to do is keep an outline, a physical outline. I'm sort of a technological Luddite. I like I'm tactile. I like to hold the notes. And if I'll write down a piece of information or fact that I think is pertinent, and that there's a corresponding sticky note in the book, and I on the actual Word document, I'll say where I got it from. So the source is there, and I can always go back and refer to it and make sure that I'm not I'm not, you know, copying it word for word, that I'm getting the gist of the information across, but in my own way. So that's what I try to do.
You're working with a lot of old materials, and those are usually in restricted areas of the library.
Yeah.
So you take your stuff in and...
Yeah, I'll either write from that or sometimes photocopy it and you know...
And they let you put sticky notes on these
things? Oh, no. Sticky notes on my photocopies.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, no. No sticky notes on the archives.
Yeah, defacing a book, it's shocking.
Yeah.
All right. I think this is the same question. You've gotten some criticism, or the same sort of question. You've gotten some criticism from some people who have written about you, reviewed your books, about using source material that was debunked at the time.
Oh.
Particularly the soldier, the woman who went undercover
exactly
as a soldier.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, that was. The bothersome aspect of that review was that she picked one pet academic, I don't know if it was somebody she knew, who claims that this story was debunked. There were other subsequent books about that same soldier that debunked the debunking and that said, well, wait a minute, there's a little bit more ambiguity here. And I, you know, I'm sure if she bothered to look at my sources more carefully, she would have seen that I talked about that in my endnotes. And also that I used primary source material that supported the idea that, you know, there is evidence here to support this soldier's, a lot of what she says in her memoir. And if there is ambiguity in her memoir, I actually put it out in the narrative. I said, this is a lie, this is an embellishment. But here is some, a story she tells that there's actually some basis in the historical record for, and I think it's fair to put it in there and then just talk a little bit about the source material in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was a lazy review, frankly, and you know, everybody gets them, so.
Absolutely, and I think that, I think there's an important message here too for students. When you've got a problem in a story or in a book, the easiest way to deal with it is to put the problem in the,
right.
in the text and
right.
address it. Don't run away from it. Don't be scared of it.
Right.
Say what you know about it and move on, in essence. Is there a temptation, though, to make up and sweeten? Because you got great stories, but, you know, it could be a little better if Belle Boyd plugged the Yankee soldier between the eyes as opposed to in the chest.
Oh, I would
whatever.
Never make up a detail like that if I didn't know
it's
that.
It's too easy to check, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Well, that and the fact that she killed the soldier and got away with it is dramatic enough. I don't need to embellish where it happened or, mm-hmm. I mean, what part, I don't need to say what part of the body happened if I don't know. You know, a lot of people say, well, you know, if you go into their heads, how do you do that? How
yes,
do you articulate
exactly.
their thought process? And I only do that when, you know, somebody's writing in their diary, they're talking about their thought process. Mm-hmm. They're talking about their thoughts and what they were thinking and feeling at the time. And so, then I feel free to use that. And if they do something that's sort of the opposite of what they said, I feel free to say, you know, she was sort of being tricky here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so people leave breadcrumbs of what they're thinking.
They do, yes.
And
yes.
I think it's fair to assemble those and put those together and you know, what's to sort of round out the character and make them an actual living, breathing human being again.
I think one of the things that the soldier, the woman who dressed as a male and then got shot and hurt and several times, and there was a discussion of sort of what she was feeling when her injury was in her leg and how that hampered her as she was riding and all that sort of stuff. Did she write about that or
did she? She did. Yeah, she talked about hemorrhaging from the lungs. That was one of the phrases she used about when she got kicked in the gut. The foot thing, she couldn't wear shoes for the rest of her life. She had problems wearing shoes for the rest of her life, and she had written about that, and the fact that she had suffered a permanent deformity. So, and a lot of the times, too, you can look up what their ailment was. If somebody was suffering from malaria, you know,
what are the symptoms?
Yeah, what are the symptoms of malaria? Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of like, even if she doesn't say, I had shaking and chills, whether she did, I can pretty much, I think it's fair to look up the symptoms of malaria and say, she was suffering from malaria, this is what she was feeling.
And that's one more of the points about doing a lot of research, knowing everything you can. Look up malaria and see what the symptoms are and how it works, so that you can get it right in the book. Now let me introduce to you, we've already done this before, but Sierra Walton, who is a junior here at SSU and majoring in journalism and mass communications, though if I remember correctly, it's the public relations track. Yes, okay. As part of your internship, part-time job, you did some research on Ms. Abbott, on Abbott, and she prefers to be called Abbott, right?
Yes.
Okay. And
no Ms. necessary.
Okay. Then wrote some questions, and some of the questions were really good.
Thank you.
Would you have at it?
Yes, especially being a college student here at Savannah State, students often have a difficult time writing in general. Can you give us some suggestions about where to find inspiration in order to make the process easier for ourselves?
When you say you have trouble writing, is it just because there's so much distraction around, or just the, what would you say the issue is?
More so having to write on a certain topic or a prompt versus creative writing, I guess.
So just having to write about something you're not really interested
right.
in. You know, I mean, that's part of the being a student, I guess. And the thing I would best say, you know, I had to do a couple of things like that in a professional job. I would get an assignment about a, you know, banker. I don't care about banking. But what I always try to do is find what's personal about it. If it's a subject or a person you're not really interested in, there's got to be one thing in there that intrigues you. There's got to be one little segment of that person's personality or background or their job, what they do, that you find a little weird or interesting or intriguing in some way. So I feel like that's your window in. And if you start there, then you can grow from there. So and maybe, get your tentacles in the whole story.
What if you're writing about something like the prime rate?
I can't help you there.
Don't write about the prime rate.
Yeah, exactly. Don't write about the prime rate.
Yeah.
Next assignment.
That was an assignment I had once, and
oh god,
it was hard.
I would maybe write about why the prime rate is boring.
I'm not sure you're allowed to do that in some situations. How about another question, Sarah?
Right. In what ways can students make their writing distinct and creative in their own way?
Well, that's something that, I mean, not only students, I think everybody struggles with. How do you find your voice? And I read something somewhere where it says, you know, you don't try to find your voice. You just, and don't try to mimic somebody's voice. Although I think a good way to maybe start learning about voices, to studying people's voices and why, what's unique about them. But at some point, it just starts coming naturally. And I feel like it's like riding a bike. At some point, you get on and it just starts happening for you. And it's basically practice. And it's sort of, the best thing I can say is read, write. I know a lot of people who are like, I want to be a writer. And I was like, well, what do you like to read? I don't really read. Really? You think you're going to be a writer? It's not going to happen. So it's like reading is part of the job. And I feel like once you see how voice works on the page, it just starts clicking for you in a personal way.
Okay. Another suggestion. Listen to books. Listen to audio books.
Yeah.
But only by people who are good writers, people you admire.
Okay.
Even if it's crime fiction, if the person tells a good story, you get their words and their sounds in your head. And from that, if you practice, you can develop a voice that is distinct and unique. Okay. We're coming to the end of our time. And there's an old reporter's question that you always apply. Yeah, it's the one that, in essence, covers your backside. And that is there anything about writing, about the kind of writing you do, nonfiction writing, or anything that we've talked about in this session that just needs saying or that you want to elaborate on? Or do you want to tell us why you're called Abbott instead of Ms. Abbott or whatever it is?
I think we were pretty thorough here. I'll tell you a story about this is something that would only happen in the internet age. One day a reader wrote to me and said, do you know if you Google yourself, it says that you died in 2010. And
yikes.
It's like, this is why I never Google myself.
Yeah.
And sure enough, I Google myself, you know, like this. And it said I died in 2010. And also that there's a romance writer named Karen Abbott whose books are sometimes listed alongside mine. And I've had people say, oh, in your spare time in between your nonfiction books, are you writing Till Death Do Us Part? I was like, no, I've never written a book called Till Death, you know. So So I wanted to start trying to distinguish myself from her. And if, you know, when I do continue to write nonfiction, it's going to be under Karen Abbott. But if I turn to fiction, I think I'm going to write under a different name. So that's why I started to carve that path out for myself.
Before the interview,
but the began, lesson, don't Google yourself.
Sorry. And before the interview started, we talked a little bit, and you said you are working on a piece of fiction.
Yeah. It's and like I can't really separate myself from my love of history and my love of fact. So it's based on a woman I read about for the Smithsonian a couple years ago, a Gilded Age con artist in New York City who sort of lies her way into New York society, and then her past starts catching up with her. And there's not enough there for a nonfiction account, so it's the first time I have to put the flesh on the bones. And I can't tell yet if it's liberating or paralyzing. I'm still at the very beginning of it, so I'm hoping it's going to be the former.
Indeed. thank you.
Thank you for having me.
To Karen Abbott, the author of a new book, well, September book called Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy. Boy, I can't get that out. who is with us because you are here at the Savannah Book Festival. We are in your debt. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having
me.
After our break, we will be back with more of The Writer's Way, a Write Attitude radio show. Thank you for tuning in. This is The Writer's Way. Next on our show, we will hear an interview with novelist and playwright Pearl Clegg. A graduate and former writer in residence of Spelman College in Atlanta, many of Clegg's novels take place in the neighborhoods in the southwest part of the city. Regardless of setting, her 9 novels and 6 plays frequently relate to themes of racism and sexism, and she has written of stories involving the civil rights movement, drug addiction, and domestic abuse and rape in the Black community. She is a women's rights activist and a recipient of the NAACP National Association for the Advancement of Colored People Image Award for her work in fiction. Here now is an interview conducted by our SSU student, Jocelyn Stargell Zachary, during Clegg's visit to Savannah State University in 2014 as part of the Savannah Black Heritage Festival.
My name is Jocelyn Stargell Zachary, and we're here with Mrs. Clegg. Is this your first time at SSU?
I've been here once before and had a really wonderful time. It was a while ago. I can't even remember exactly when, but I've been on the campus before and had a great time, so I'm very happy to be back.
That's good. Are you glad to be speaking at the University by the Sea?
Absolutely. I'm glad to be by the sea. It's such a beautiful campus, and it's really, this festival is such a wonderful part of Savannah life, so I'm very happy to be a part of it.
Oh, that's interesting. So how much research do you do for your books and plays?
Well, it takes me about a year to write either a full-length play or a book. It takes about a year. Mm-hmm. And in that time, I do whatever the research is. I do all that first. And then I do a lot of work on the characters. Mm-hmm. Some people come to their work through the plot. You know, they know who's going to do what and where the chase is going to take place and all of that. But I really come to it through the characters. So I spend a lot of time, most of my research is trying to figure out who these people are that I'm going to spend a year with. So it varies, but the whole process ends up taking about a year.
Okay, and would you say that's the hardest thing, developing the character?
Yes, it is, because once you really know these people, then the rest of it kind of falls into place. But you have to figure out who the people are first, and I do lots of work. I mean, down to where I know what these people's favorite colors are, I know what their grandmother did for a living, I know all of that, because all of these characters start off as me, the writer, trying to pretend to be someone else. So that what you have to do as a writer is to make sure that by the time you actually get this book on paper or get this play on the stage, it's not you anymore. Mm-hmm. It's really Charles or Maria or Candace or whoever these characters are. Mm-hmm. So that you have to really do the work to make sure that you're not just pretending that it's somebody else, but they really like everything you like, they eat everything you eat, they're mm-hmm. the same size as you are. You have to say, no, this is someone else. So what do they do on their off day? You know, I even when I'm writing, I go through the grocery store for my, you know, buying food for my family, and I think to myself, okay, what would this character buy? You know, would she buy avocados? Would she buy tomatoes? Does she hate Mexican food? You know, what kind of stuff does she eat? And the more you know about their personal lives, the more the plot that you come up with really grows out of who they are. You know, you can't do something where somebody's really a housebound person, stays in the house all the time, and then have part of the plot that they ride a motorcycle across town. Mm-hmm. That would never happen. Mm-hmm. So that you have to really know the people, and then the story kind of emerges from that.
All right, that's interesting. So what advice would you give to aspiring writers?
I think the most important thing is to write every day. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard, I think, for young writers, especially when you're in school and you've got writing assignments and books you have to read and all of those things that you must do. But the most important thing is to practice. And if you do it every day, what you find is not only do you get better much faster, but you can see the pages mounting. You know, a lot of times when you start writing, you feel like, okay, unless I have 4 hours to sit here, I shouldn't really waste my time. But even if all you have is 20 minutes a day, it's really important to get in the habit of going to the same place, if you can, sit down in that same place and write for half an hour and just see what happens. After a month, you would be amazed if you write for half an hour every day, how many pages you have at the end of the month, so that it encourages you to do more, to go on and do more. So I think the most important thing is to set some time every day when you take your writing seriously and put those words on paper.
Well, do you think it's a difference between writing a book and a play? Like two different platforms?
Well, the process is the same, but it's very different. I started off writing plays. I'm trained as a playwright, so that I have the time that I have to write when I'm by myself. But then after that, when you go into rehearsal, you're in with a whole bunch of other people. You've got actors and designers and directors and producers and all of those people with you. When you write a novel, you write it by yourself. People read it by themselves. So there isn't that experience that you get in theater where you also have the gifts that the actors bring. You know, if you do it in a novel, you have to make all of those gifts on that page. If you're doing it on the stage, then you can write whatever it is and know that you're going to have an actor who is a real live person saying these things, which is a great difference between the two. And I find that although I've written books and plays, that plays I really enjoy more because it's so much more a group effort that we collaborate as artists together for the final product. So then I can sit in the back of the house on opening night and watch them and say, they got this, I can go home. This is done now.
Oh, that's good. So attending colleges such as Howard and Spelman, what can you say about the HBCU experience?
Oh, I had a great experience at Howard and a great experience at Spelman. And I went specifically looking for a black college. I went to school in the mid-60s, so that a lot of the bigger northern colleges who had not been very open to black students were opening and consciously trying to recruit us to come to Barnard, come to Vassar, come to Mount Holyoke. And I really did not have an interest in doing that. I wanted to go to an HBCU. I wanted to be around other black students who were pursuing their dreams just like I was, and I had a great time at Howard. When I was at Howard, it was a time of great demonstrations and all of that, so that we could always leave the campus after class, go down, pick at the White House, come back, go down, protest the war, and come back. So it was a very exciting time to be a student. When I got to Spelman, I had already been in college for 3 years, so that I understood kind of what I wanted to do, and it was a different kind of experience because it was a much smaller campus. It was an all-woman school, which was very different. But I think that the experience that a historically black college can offer is just very unique, and it's really wonderful. I couldn't have asked for better education and better lifelong experiences that really have carried me forward.
So do you think it has changed over the years from now and then at HBCUs?
Oh, I think so. I think the world has changed so that I think, you know, students have changed, people have changed, the way you study, the way you get your information. You know, I mean, I'm of the generation where you go to the library, there's a card catalog. You have to look up the book you want, take the little dusty card to the librarian, they get the book for you and bring it back. You all can go on a phone and get any information in the world that you want, which is very different in terms of process, but it's also different in how it trains your mind to work. You all work much faster, much faster. You think faster, you draw conclusions much faster. And whether or not that's a good thing, we have to wait another 100 years and see. But I think it's very different. But I think these campuses, the HBCU campuses, have really responded well to the changes in the environment and are constantly upgrading and trying to make sure that these campuses stay competitive with everyone else, so that when we come out from an HBCU as a graduate, we know we can compete with anybody anywhere.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. So awesome. What inspired you to become a writer?
I'm very lucky in that I always knew I was a writer. Even when I was a little kid, I used to tell stories. I have a big sister who's 2 years older than I am. And I used to stand in my crib when I was a little tiny kid. I mean, I was still in the crib, so I must have been about two. And lean over the side of the crib and tell stories to my sister. And then when she learned how to read, I realized that kids could also read and write. I knew grown-ups could. I never knew kids could. So I made her teach me how to read and write when I was four. And I started writing little stories in notebooks. My grandfather would give me these little spiral notebooks I could get at the CVS with little pencils, and I would write my stories. And I always did it. I was the kind of kid who, after Thanksgiving dinner, you know, I would put on a play with my cousins and all of that. So I always knew, and I think that really is a great advantage, because some people want to write and they always say, I want to be a writer, I want to be a writer, but they can't give themselves permission to actually do it, you know, to do the work that you have to do and to take the time that you need to do it. And since I knew so young that this is really what I wanted to do, tell stories, that I was able to construct my life around making sure that I had the time to do that. You know, I would take jobs that I knew I didn't have to really invest my heart and soul in, because I knew I wanted that for my other job, which was writing. It wasn't paying me any money, but that was the job I really wanted to do, so that I was able to really balance those things, I think, in a way that was easier for me, because that was the only thing I ever wanted to do, was to be a working writer.
Okay. Do you feel like your upbringing inspires a lot of your novels and plays?
Oh, I do. Absolutely. My parents were very much involved in the civil rights movement and the black arts movement. They were very community-oriented people, so that we always had, my father ran for office, my father was a minister, always had meetings at the church, always had demonstrations, all of that. We were very much involved in that. It's just a part of life. So I think that most of my work is very deeply rooted in community, in trying to say, you know, whatever the problem is, if we all get together, we can fix it. So that, I'm sure that came from the kind of upbringing I had.
All right, and lastly, what is your favorite positive saying that you would give to young writers?
You can do it. Mm-hmm. You can do it. And I think that's the big thing. Writers doubt themselves. All artists do. We doubt ourselves, and we, you know, begin to think, well, maybe I'm not as good as I think I am. And we listen to people who doubt us and all of that. You know, I've been reading all these things about Bruno Mars at the Super Bowl show yesterday, and all these things saying, oh, he's too young, he can't do it, he doesn't know what he's doing and all that. And I don't think he ever let any of that permeate his thinking. So when he got to do it yesterday, to actually do the show, he was fabulous, because he had absolute confidence. And I think that that's such an important part of it, that you have to always have that voice in your head, no matter what anybody else is saying, that's saying, you can do it, you can do it, you can do it.
Oh, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. So nice to meet you. Thank you.
And you have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.
Let's have our last break, and we will be back with more of The Writer's Way, a Write Attitude radio show. Stay tuned in to listen to scenes from two of the plays written by Pearl Clegg. They were recorded by our students, Maya Codwell and Natalie Goings, and directed by Daryl Thompson, professor of fine arts at Savannah State University. The scenes were recorded at one of the studios at WHCJ 90.3 FM, Savannah State University's radio station.
I'm Dr. Lisa Yant, the director of the Write Attitude program at Savannah State University. Here's the writing tip of the day.
I am Deanne Goins, a professional writing tutor at the SSU Writing Center, and I bring you the Write Attitude writing tip of the day. Sentences must have a subject and a verb and express a complete thought. Fragments commonly occur when one of the elements of a sentence is missing.
The Write Attitude writing tip of the day is brought to you by the SSU Writing Center and the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Write Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative to enhance student learning by improving attitudes about writing. Visit the SSU Writing Center in Payne Hall to get assistance with your writing projects, and to learn more about how you can improve your writing attitudes and skills, visit qep.savannahstate.edu.
Welcome back to the show. You've been listening to an interview with Pearl Clegg here on The Writer's Way. Up next, we will play recorded scenes from two of her plays. First, we will listen to an excerpt from Blues for an Alabama Sky, which in 1995 debuted at the Alliance Theater in Atlanta and starred Felicia Rashad. Maya Codwell, SSU student, will be performing Blues from an Alabama Sky. Professor of Fine Arts Daryl Thompson is the narrator and director of the recording.
In Blues for an Alabama Sky, it is the summer of 1930 in Harlem, New York.
It is the Great Depression. Young Reverend Adam Clayton Powell Jr. is feeding the hungry and preaching an activist gospel at the Abyssinian Baptist Church. Black nationalist visionary Marcus Garvey has been discredited and deported. Birth control pioneer Margaret Sanger is opening a new family clinic on 126th Street, and the doctors at Harlem Hospital are scrambling to care for a population whose most deadly disease is poverty. In the Harlem apartment of Guy, a popular costume designer, and his friend, we have Angel, a recently fired Cotton Club backup singer, and Leland, a recent transplant from Tuskegee, who sees in Angel a memory of lost love and a reminder of those Alabama skies where the stars are so thick it's bright as day. Guy says to fulfill their dreams, they need to look beyond 125th Street. Early in the story, Angel reminisces about a boyfriend, her hopes, and her innocence.
The whole time I was going around with Nikki, the whole time I was singing at the club, I kept thinking something wonderful was going to happen. But it never did. In my mind, I could see myself doing all these things with Nick, riding around in fancy cars, wearing furs, him giving me diamonds. I even saw us getting married. But mostly all we did was go to his place after I'd do a show. Half the time, his friends would come over with us. They'd all sit around drinking and playing cards like I wasn't even there. Then when I asked him to take me home, he'd tell me he wanted me to stay around and bring him good luck. I remember wishing I could bring myself some luck for once in a while.
Later in the story, the harsh reality of her life has been recognized. Angel talks about her latest gentleman friend.
Tony kept saying he could look out for me, offer me some protection in these hard times. He didn't want a singer any more than you do. He wanted to keep a colored woman stashed up in Harlem so he could come by every now and then and rub her head for good luck. No Negro woman should have anything. When I was sitting there at Tony's this afternoon, I saw him looking like he could see right through my clothes. And I knew he had talked to Nick about me. I didn't have to imagine what they said. I heard them talk about women. I know what they say. But I wouldn't let myself think about that. I pushed it right out of my mind because I know how to take care of myself. I'm not going to be some broke old woman begging down 125th Street dreaming about fine clothes and French champagne. So I drank with him. I listened to him telling me how long he'd been waiting to get to know me better. I watched him put his hand on my knee like I wouldn't notice, and I pretended not to. I laughed and laughed and laughed and just kept up the noise in the room. It was so quiet. Then I stood up to pour another drink and I saw myself in the mirror. And I thought, what is that poor, crazy colored woman laughing at?
Now we will listen to a monologue from the one character play, Chain, which was first performed in 1992 at the Judith Anderson Theater in New York City. The following scene was performed by Savannah State student Natalie Goings under the direction of Professor Daryl Thompson, who was also the narrator.
Chain tells the tale of a 16-year-old crack addict, Rosa Jackson, whose parents take matters into their own hands. Their solution, to keep their daughter chained inside their home for 7 days. In this desperate attempt to keep their daughter away from drugs and the violence of their Harlem community, Rosa teeters between discovering her self-worth the admiration for her boyfriend Jesus, who introduced her to the drug, and the reality of her addiction.
Mama? Mama? Is that you? I hear you out there, Mama. I hear you out there listening. What kind of mother are you? How can you let him do this to me? You hate me. You all hate me. Mama? Mama, are you still listening? Mama, are you still out there? I didn't mean it, Mama. You know I didn't mean it. I know you love me. It's me. You know, it's me. I love you, Mama. Mama, can you hear me? I know you can hear me. I can hear you breathing. Talk to me, Mama. Say something. Well, don't then. I don't care what you do. You can't keep me in here if I don't want to stay. I'll get away. I'll get away just like I always do. You know I can do it, Mama. And you know I will. So you might as well go on to work and stop waiting to see what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna do what I damn well please. And there's nothing you can do about it. Not a damn thing. Now, how do you like that? Mama? Please let me out, Mama. I won't tell Daddy. I promise. He'll never know the difference. I won't go nowhere. I swear. I was just kidding. You can trust me, Mama. Honest. Open this door and look at me. You scared to see me like this. Well, that's just too damn bad because you gotta deal with it. Look at me. I'm a dope fiend. Mama ain't cried when I went to rehab since I was 13, so I know this was something, some serious crap. I know this sounds crazy, but I thought they was gonna kill me. I could tell it was something heavy in the bag, and I thought maybe Daddy had, like, a sledgehammer or something, and they was gonna beat me to death and put me in a bag and drop me in the river. Crazy, right? But you know your mind give you all kind of mess when you get scared. Then Daddy takes out this big-ass chain, and I freaked. I started running around the room, and I tried to hold on to Mama, and she was holding me, and we was both crying. Looked like the color purple. Save me, Mama! Save me! But that didn't work on Daddy no better than it did in the girl in the movie. He pulled my hands off of Mama and made her go to work. She didn't want to go, and I was screaming and crying and begging her not to do this to me, and she was crying too, but Daddy was holding me so tight I could hardly breathe, and he kept talking to Mama in this very calm voice and reminding her that they had talked about this and telling her that this was the only way, and it was for my own good. So she looked at me, and then she grabbed her purse and ran out the room. Then it was just me and Daddy. Jesus should have been looking for me by now. He don't give a damn about me. He never did. He just hung around me for the crack. I don't know why he hung around me. He don't even know I'm here. He would have figured out some way to contact me. He could slide a note under the door or something. Damn! If he could slide a letter under... I'm not gonna make it.
They was getting ready to shoot through the door at first, and I said, no, that sounds like my dad. So they told him if he didn't pay the $100 I owed them, they'd blow my brains out right in front of him. My daddy just stood there for a minute, looking at that fool holding his 9mm against my head, and I'm thinking, my daddy ain't got that kind of money. I'm dead. And then he reached in his pocket and took out a roll of money and handed it to the guy who had been in the bedroom with me. He counted it right in front of my daddy, and it was $100 exactly. That's how I know Jesus, the one who told him to come get me. How else my daddy gonna be walking around Harlem with a pocket full of cash like he the dope man? My daddy didn't even look at me. He took off his jacket and put it around my shoulders, and we walked the 3 blocks home with him holding my arm, and like you did a little kid when they'd been bad. He wouldn't say nothing. When we got home, my mama was there, and she started crying and holding my face so she could look at me. I hadn't eaten in two or three days, and my clothes was all twisted around, and I know my hair was all over my head because she kept smoothing it down, and it kept rising. It kept rising right back up, and she'd smooth it down again, and it would rise on back up. My head was itching too, but I couldn't scratch it or nothing because my mama was hugging me, and she had my arms pinned down at the sides, and you can't push your mama off of you, even if you wanted to. So I'm standing there trying to get her to calm down, and I catch an eye full of my pops sitting at the table, and tears just running down his face. He ain't crying or hollering or nothing. He just sitting there looking at me and mama stumbling around the room like we drunk. That hurt me worse than anything. I never seen my daddy cry in my life. Never. I seen him mad plenty of times, but not over me. So I felt real bad when I saw him crying over me. I love my daddy. So I got up, I got away from my mama, and I went over and stood in front of him, and I said, don't worry about me, Daddy. I'm okay. And he just looked at me, and tears running all down his chin, act like he didn't even know he was doing it. I didn't have no Kleenex or nothing, but I hated to see him like that, so I just wiped them off little with my sleeve, right? He caught my hand and held it so hard, I thought he was gonna crush my damn fingers, and he just looked at me and started saying my name over and over and over like he wasn't sure it was even me. Rosa. Rosa. Rosa! I'm not gonna make it.
This marks the end of another episode of The Writer's Way. Thank you for tuning in and listening to these fine writers, Karen Abbott and Pearl Clegg, discuss their work. We hope that you aspiring writers out there learn some valuable advice, and we hope that all of our listeners learn something about how these authors take care to portray strong female characters, demonstrating the importance of female voices in understanding the past as well as the world around us today. Don't forget that you can listen to all of the Right Attitude Radio shows by visiting the Quality Enhancement Plan website, qep.savannahstate.edu. I wish to thank those who helped make this show possible, including the authors themselves, the QEP's own Adriana de Oliveira and Lisa Yant, as well as professors Daryl Thompson and Sandra Early, and SSU students Maya Codwell, Natalie Goings, and Jocelyn Stargell Zachary, Ryan Clark for his help in production, Tiger Roar TV, and Grace Curry at WHCJ for their support. Have a pleasant day and tune in next time for more episodes of The Writer's Way. I am your host, Sierra Walton. See you on the next Right Attitude Radio Show. I'm your host, Sierra Walton. See you on the next Right Attitude Radio Show.
Thank you.